Loneliness is one of the deepest fears of the human heart. We live in a world built around belonging, families, friendships, communities, schools, and endless social networks that promise connection. From the moment we're children, we're told to fit in, to be liked, to be accepted. Yet here lies the paradox. In a culture obsessed with belonging, more and more people feel profoundly alone. We scroll through endless feeds filled with other people's lives, but feel unseen in our own. We attend parties or sit in crowded cafes, but sense a hollowness within. This paradox reveals something vital. Being surrounded by people is not the same as truly belonging, and belonging itself can become a prison when it demands the sacrifice of who you really are. Picture the samurai walking alone through a fog-covered valley, sword at his side, his steps steady and calm. He has no master, no clan, no one to lean on, yet he carries himself with dignity. Imagine Diogenes curled inside his barrel, laughing at the conventions of Athens, free precisely because he needs nothing from society. Or Nietzsche, hiking alone in the mountains of Switzerland, wrestling with his thoughts as the wind howls around him, far from the noise of the crowd. These images strike something primal in us. They remind us that solitude, though frightening, holds a strange kind of power. These figures embody the truth that walking alone is not weakness. It is the ultimate strength, because it means you no longer depend on others to define who you are. Most people confuse solitude with abandonment. They think being alone means being unloved, unwanted, or forgotten. But solitude, when chosen, is none of these things. It is the deliberate act of separating yourself from the crowd so you can hear your own thoughts, test your own strength, and discover your own values. In solitude, you are no longer shielded by the safety of conformity. There is no group to hide behind, no master to follow, no applause to reassure you. It is just you, and that is where the true test of character begins. The path of walking alone is not easy, but it is essential for those who refuse to follow blindly. Throughout history, the greatest thinkers and warriors have chosen this dangerous freedom. Diogenes mocked the crowd and became untouchable. The Ronin lived without masters, bound only by their own code. Nietzsche endured isolation to forge ideas that still shape the world today. They show us that solitude is not an absence, but a presence. The presence of authenticity, courage, and inner strength. Most people go to great lengths to avoid being alone. They fill their days with constant noise, music playing in the background, endless scrolling on their phones, television shows running while they fall asleep. Silence makes them restless, and solitude feels unbearable. This is not simply a modern problem, it is something deeply wired into us as human beings. For most of history, being alone meant danger. A single person separated from their tribe could starve, fall prey to animals, or be attacked by outsiders. Belonging was not just a matter of emotional comfort, it was survival. That ancient instinct still lives in us today, even though we no longer face the same risks. Our biology tells us that rejection is a threat and solitude means weakness. This is why so many chase approval. Why we measure our worth in likes and followers, and why being excluded from a group feels almost unbearable. Yet what once kept us alive has now turned into a prison, preventing us from ever discovering who we truly are when the crowd is stripped away. Solitude terrifies because it removes the mirror of other people's opinions. Most of us only know ourselves through reflection, through the way others respond to us, through the roles we play in society, through the approval or disapproval that comes from those around us. When you step away from all of that, when you sit in a room with no one else to validate you, you're forced to face the raw truth of your own existence. That can be uncomfortable, even painful, questions emerge. Who am I if no one is watching? What do I actually believe if I'm not repeating what others expect me to say? Can I bear my own company without distraction? These are questions solitude demands, and most would rather drown them out than answer them. Yet throughout history, there have always been figures who dared to walk the outsider's path, figures who embraced solitude not as punishment, but as liberation. Take Diogenes, the Cynic philosopher who lived in Athens during the 4th century BCE. He mocked wealth, fame, and social norms, and instead chose to live in a large ceramic jar, often described as a barrel. He had no home, no possessions of value, and no desire for status. He wandered the streets, sometimes holding a lamp in broad daylight, claiming he was searching for an honest man. His life was a rejection of the very foundation of society. To most Athenians, he was a madman. But in truth, Diogenes was freer than all of them, because he no longer needed society's approval to define him. By choosing solitude, by choosing to stand apart from the expectations of his time, he discovered a kind of radical independence that few could imagine. The samurai offer another example of this path. In feudal Japan, honor and loyalty were central to their code. To be a warrior was to serve a master, to dedicate one's life to duty. But when a samurai lost his master, whether through death, disgrace, or betrayal, he became a ronin, a warrior without a lord. To be ronin was considered shameful, a mark of dishonor. Yet some embraced this solitude as a way of living beyond rigid hierarchies. They wandered as mercenaries, philosophers, or swordsmen who lived by their own discipline rather than submission to authority. Miyamoto Musashi, perhaps the most famous swordsman in Japanese history, lived as a ronin for most of his life. He fought over 60 duels, never bound by a single master, and in his later years wrote Dokkodo, The Path of Walking Alone. Musashi's philosophy revealed that true mastery comes not from obedience, but from self-discipline and independence. The samurai who could walk alone, without the safety of a clan, embodied both danger and freedom at once. Nietzsche, too, saw solitude as essential for the higher individual. He often described the philosopher as someone who must retreat to the mountains, both literally and metaphorically. In his writings, the image of the mountain appears again and again, the place of clarity, of air so thin that few can breathe it, the lonely heights where one must endure isolation in order to see farther than the crowd below. Nietzsche himself lived this truth. He spent much of his life in solitude, battling illness, estranged from his peers, wandering through Switzerland and Italy in search of health and quiet. For him, the mountain was not simply a place, it was a metaphor for what it meant to rise above common thinking. To reach the summit, you must first accept the loneliness of the climb. The herd remains in the valley, comfortable and safe, but the one who dares to rise will always walk apart. Solitude was not a curse to Nietzsche, it was the furnace in which greatness is forged. When we put these examples together, Diogenes laughing at society, Musashi sharpening his sword alone, Nietzsche breathing the cold air of the Alps, we see a pattern emerge. Solitude is not about being abandoned. It is not about rejection or exile. It is about choosing to step away, to break free from the crowd in order to cultivate inner strength. This is why solitude, though terrifying, is also transformative. It strips away the illusions of belonging and forces you to face life directly. It is important here to distinguish solitude from isolation. Isolation is what happens when solitude is forced upon you, when you are cut off from others against your will. Solitude, by contrast, is a choice. It is a conscious step into independence. The difference between the two is empowerment. The one who isolates feels powerless, but the one who chooses solitude discovers freedom. This is why the outsider's path is not meant for escape. It is meant for discovery. To walk alone is not to reject humanity entirely, but to no longer allow yourself to be enslaved by it. The practical question is how to begin. Solitude doesn't mean disappearing into the mountains forever or renouncing all possessions. It can start with something as simple as sitting quietly for an hour without a phone, without music, without distraction. It can mean going for a walk without telling anyone, letting your thoughts settle without interference. It can mean daring to hold an opinion that others might dislike, refusing to nod along when you disagree. These small acts of solitude strengthen the mind, preparing you for larger moments when you may need to stand against the crowd. In choosing solitude, you are choosing to hear your own voice above the noise of the world. The outsider's path requires courage because it is lonely at first. You may feel misunderstood, criticized, or ignored. But history shows that every great philosopher, every great warrior, every great creator has had to walk alone at some point. They endured solitude not as punishment, but as preparation. They understood that belonging to themselves was more valuable than belonging to a crowd. And they discovered that once you are no longer afraid of walking alone, you can never truly be enslaved again. So solitude should not be feared, it should be embraced. It is not the end of connection, but the beginning of authenticity. To walk alone is to declare, I no longer need the approval of others to live my truth. That is why solitude, though terrifying, is the ultimate freedom. It may set you apart, but it also sets you free. Diogenes was one of the most unusual and provocative figures in the history of philosophy. He lived in Athens over 2,000 years ago, during a time when wealth, status, and social order defined one's worth. While other philosophers founded schools, wrote treatises, or sought influence among politicians, Diogenes chose the life of a beggar. He rejected the comforts of society so completely that he lived inside a large clay jar in the middle of the city. He owned almost nothing, ate scraps, and wandered barefoot, carrying only a staff, a cloak, and a small bag. When he saw a boy drinking water from his hands, Diogenes immediately threw away his only cup, saying that even this was unnecessary. To most Athenians, he was outrageous, perhaps even insane, yet his way of living was deliberate. He was making a point. Freedom comes not from having more, but from needing less. One of the most famous stories about Diogenes involves his encounter with Alexander the Great, the most powerful man in the world at the time. Alexander, curious about this strange philosopher, sought him out. He found Diogenes lying in the sun, resting. Standing before him, the conqueror of the nations asked, "Is there anything I can do for you?" Diogenes looked up, squinted against the light, and replied, "Yes, stand out of my sunlight." That was all. No flattery, no request, no interest in pleasing the man who controlled empires. In that moment, Alexander may have ruled armies and kingdoms, but Diogenes showed he ruled himself. When Alexander later reflected on the meeting, he is said to have told his companions, "If I were not Alexander, I would wish to be Diogenes." This story endures because it captures the essence of freedom, to need nothing from others, even from kings. The lesson here is radical and deeply uncomfortable for most people. True freedom is not measured by how much power or wealth you can accumulate. It is measured by how little you need from others to feel complete. Diogenes demonstrated that when you stop chasing approval, possessions, and validation, you become untouchable. No one can control you with promises or threats because you have nothing to lose. This is what made him so dangerous and yet so inspiring. He mocked Athenian society by showing them that their luxuries, their politics, and their obsession with appearances were fragile illusions. They relied on them for meaning, but he did not. In his barrel, With nothing but his cloak and his wit, he was freer than the richest noble in Athens. This brings us to the contrast between approval and authenticity. Most people spend their lives chasing approval, trying to be liked, admired, and respected. They adjust their words, their clothes, even their personalities to fit in. They post curated versions of their lives online, hoping for likes and comments that act as little injections of validation. But this dependence on approval is a chain, even if it feels pleasant. The moment you need other people to constantly reassure you, you are no longer living authentically. You are performing. Approval may give temporary comfort, but it robs you of freedom. Authenticity, on the other hand, is raw, unfiltered, and sometimes uncomfortable. It may cost you popularity or praise, but it gives you back your integrity. To live authentically means to stop asking, "What will they think of me?" and start asking, "What do I truly think of myself?" Diogenes embodied authenticity in its purest form. He didn't care how absurd he looked, how offensive his words seemed, or how much people mocked him. He barked at passers-by, urinated in public, and ridiculed philosophers who preached virtue while living in luxury. Everything he did was meant to strip away pretense. He lived as though society's rules were a game, and he had simply decided not to play. In doing so, he revealed something powerful. When you no longer need validation, you become unshakable. People may laugh at you, but their laughter loses its power when you don't depend on their approval. People may reject you, but rejection means nothing if you are not desperate to belong. This is the heart of the Cynic philosophy that Diogenes founded. Virtue and freedom are found not in gaining, but in discarding. How do we apply this to our modern lives? We may not want to live in a barrel or throw away all our possessions, but the spirit of Diogenes is as relevant today as ever. We live in an age of constant comparison and relentless approval seeking. Social media makes it nearly impossible to escape the trap. Every post, every photo, every comment becomes a test. Do people like me? Do I belong? Am I good enough? The problem is not the platforms themselves, but the addiction to validation they create. To live like Diogenes is to break this addiction, to reclaim your independence from the opinions of strangers. It means daring to speak the truth even when it is unpopular, to live according to your values rather than what gains approval, and to find satisfaction in yourself rather than applause. A practical way to begin is by practicing what we might call radical honesty. Try going a whole day without filtering yourself to please others. This doesn't mean being cruel or reckless, but it does mean refusing to pretend. If you don't agree with something, admit it. If you don't enjoy an activity, stop saying yes just to fit in. If you're tired of curating a false version of yourself online, post nothing at all. Radical honesty cuts through the fog of approval seeking and forces you to confront what you actually think and feel. It can be uncomfortable, because it may reveal how often you bend to please others. But it is liberating, because it slowly frees you from the constant performance. Another exercise is to schedule what could be called a day of deliberate disregard. Choose one day to do something without caring at all what others will think. It could be wearing something unfashionable, refusing to check your phone, or speaking your mind on an issue where you usually stay silent. The point is not to shock or offend for the sake of it, but to taste what it feels like to live outside the cage of other people's opinions. Even a small act of disregard builds the muscle of authenticity. You realize that the world doesn't collapse when you stop begging for approval. In fact, you feel stronger because you have proven to yourself that you can survive without constant validation. A digital detox is another powerful step. Social media, for all its usefulness, is designed to keep you hooked on attention. It trains your brain to crave the tiny rewards of likes and shares. Taking a break, even just for a weekend, can feel uncomfortable at first, but it quickly reveals how dependent we are on external signals. When you log off, you're left alone with your own thoughts. At first, this may feel empty, but soon it can feel refreshing, you begin to notice that life is not measured by how many people acknowledge it online. Life becomes quieter, slower, and more your own. That space is where authenticity grows. Diogenes would likely laugh at our modern anxieties. He would mock the way we measure worth by followers, the way we perform happiness for the camera, the way we fear silence as though it were death. He would remind us that we need very little to live well. Food, shelter, honesty, courage. Everything else is decoration, and if it enslaves us, it is not worth having. His disdain was not bitterness, but freedom. By mocking society, he freed himself from its grip. His laughter at Alexander was the laughter of a man who needed nothing, not even the approval of a king. To embrace Diogenes' lesson is to step into a kind of fearless living. When you need less, you fear less. When you stop chasing approval, you stop being controlled. When you live authentically, you walk lighter because you carry no masks. This is not an easy path because it may mean losing some of the comfort that comes from fitting in, but it is the path of freedom, and once you have tasted it, you realize how heavy the chains of approval once were. The invitation, then, is simple. Stop begging to be liked. Stop editing yourself to fit the crowd. Stop living for validation. Choose honesty over performance, authenticity over approval. Even if people mock you, reject you, or misunderstand you, you will be freer than they are. And in that freedom lies the strength that Diogenes discovered, the strength to lie in the sun, laugh at the world, and say to kings and commoners alike, "Stand out of my light." A ronin was a samurai without a master. In feudal Japan, the identity of a samurai was tied completely to service. A warrior's honor came from loyalty to his lord, his clan, and his role in a tightly woven social order. To be without a master meant to be cut off from that identity, drifting without protection, status, or purpose. Ronin were often looked down upon as dishonored men, wanderers who no longer belonged anywhere. Yet in that very displacement, was a strange kind of freedom. A samurai tied to his master lived by duty, his life bound to the commands of another. A ronin, however, had no such ties. He walked without belonging, answering only to himself. The term carried stigma in its time, but today it resonates with anyone who feels they cannot or will not conform to the role society assigns them. To be ronin is to be untethered, which can be terrifying. But it also offers the rare chance to live authentically without disguise. The most famous ronin in history was Miyamoto Musashi. Born in the late 16th century, Musashi was a master swordsman who fought more than 60 duels, undefeated in them all. He lived as a wanderer, never serving one master for long. In a time when most samurai sought security in allegiance, Musashi rejected the safety of attachment. He slept outdoors, traveled constantly, and refined his skills not in the courts of lords but on the open road. His victories made him legendary, but it was his philosophy that endured far beyond his battles. In his final years, Musashi wrote Dokodo, which means the path of walking alone. This was a set of 21 principles that reflected his life as a ronin. Detached from possessions, free from desire, unshaken by praise or criticism. Musashi's path was not about rebellion for its own sake. It was about discipline, clarity, and independence. His life showed that to walk alone is not to be lost, but to forge your own way. The paradox of the ronin's life is worth pausing on. To live without a master meant danger. A samurai under a lord had protection, income, and belonging. A ronin had none of these things. He could be attacked, scorned, or left to starve. In many ways, he lived precariously, never sure of where his next opportunity would come from. Yet this same lack of security was also his greatest source of freedom. With no master to obey, the Ronin was answerable only to himself. His decisions were not dictated by the politics of a clan or the orders of a superior. His path might be uncertain, but it was his own. This is the essence of freedom, the ability to choose your own way, even if it comes with risk. Safety and belonging can offer comfort, but they often demand submission. Freedom, on the other hand, demands courage. Musashi embodied this paradox with clarity. In Dokodo, he wrote about the necessity of detachment. Do not seek pleasure for its own sake. Do not hold on to possessions you no longer need. Do not fear death. These principles reflected a life where nothing external could be relied upon. If you are attached to wealth, to comfort, to the approval of others, then you are vulnerable to losing them. The Ronin's way was to cut away these attachments, to build strength that came only from within. In this way, Musashi's path was not just about the sword, it was about mastering the self. To walk alone, he taught, is to live in such a way that nothing can enslave you, not desire, not fear, not obligation. When we bring this idea into modern life, the parallel is striking. Today, we may not serve literal masters, but we are often bound by invisible ones. Careers can act like lords, demanding loyalty at the cost of our health and time. Relationships can become cages when built on dependence rather than love. Ideologies, whether political, cultural, or religious, can become masters when we follow them blindly without thinking for ourselves. To live like a Ronin is not necessarily to abandon these things, but to refuse blind conformity to them. It is to enter into them with awareness and choice rather than submission. If a job demands that you sacrifice your soul for a paycheck, the Ronin spirit reminds you that no paycheck is worth slavery. If a relationship asks you to abandon your values, the Ronin spirit whispers that solitude is preferable to false connection. If an ideology pressures you to repeat its slogans without thought, the Ronin spirit pushes you to stand apart and ask your own questions. This is not an easy path. It is always easier to obey than to think for yourself, to conform rather than risk rejection, to cling to safety instead of embracing uncertainty. That is why Musashi's example is so important. His life shows that walking alone is not about recklessness, it is about discipline. The Ronin who lacked inner discipline would quickly fall into despair or chaos. But the Ronin who cultivated self-control, clarity, and strength could thrive even without belonging. This is the challenge of being your own master. No one else will guide you, so you must guide yourself. Building this kind of inner discipline requires practice. In the absence of external authority, you must create your own structure. This might mean setting daily rituals that keep you steady, waking early, journaling, meditating, or exercising, not because someone else told you to, but because you have chosen to master yourself. It might mean refusing easy comforts, deliberately practicing discomfort, so that you are never dependent on luxury. Musashi often emphasized simplicity, living lightly, carrying little, needing little, because simplicity keeps you sharp. In a world filled with distraction, the discipline of simplicity becomes even more important. When you no longer rely on others to give your life order, you discover the strength of your own will. Walking the path of the Ronin today also means embracing uncertainty. Musashi did not know where his path would take him, and neither do we. But the lesson is that uncertainty is not the enemy. When you are bound by a master, whether a job, a relationship, or an ideology, your future may seem secure, but that security can vanish at any moment. The Ronin accepts that life is unpredictable and chooses to meet it with readiness rather than fear. This mindset frees you from the constant anxiety of clinging to what cannot be controlled. Instead of worrying about losing, you focus on preparing yourself to adapt, to endure, and to continue walking no matter what changes. Another crucial part of this discipline is learning to be comfortable in solitude. The Ronin often traveled alone, slept alone, fought alone. Modern life offers constant escape from solitude, but to follow the Ronin's way is to deliberately seek it. Time spent alone becomes a forge for the self, sharpening clarity and courage. Musashi spent much of his life wandering in nature, using solitude not as isolation, but as training. In the same way, we can use solitude as a time for reflection, self-mastery, and creativity. To walk alone is to realize that your worth does not depend on the presence or approval of others. The way of the Ronin is not about glorifying isolation, but about realizing that true belonging begins with belonging to yourself. When you are your own master, you can still choose to serve, to love, to connect. But you do so freely, not because you fear the alternative. You are not chained by obligation or dependence. You choose your path, and that choice is what makes it authentic. The challenge, then, is simple but profound. Build the inner discipline to be your own master. This does not happen overnight. It begins with small acts of independence, making decisions without asking for constant reassurance, spending time alone without distraction, questioning the beliefs you have inherited. It grows as you prove to yourself again and again that you can stand without leaning. Discipline is forged not in grand gestures, but in daily practice. Each choice to walk your own path, however small, strengthens your ability to stand free. Musashi's life and teachings remind us that freedom without discipline is chaos, but discipline without freedom is slavery. The Ronin's path is the balance between the two, walking alone with danger on every side, but with freedom in your heart. It is a path of courage, simplicity, and mastery of the self. To follow it today is not to abandon the world, but to engage with it on your own terms. The question is not whether you will walk alone, for at some point in life you inevitably will. The question is whether you will walk alone in fear, or whether you will walk alone in freedom as your own master. Friedrich Nietzsche is one of those rare thinkers who forces us to look at life without illusions. He stripped away the comforting lies that people tell themselves and instead demanded that we face the rawness of existence with courage. At the heart of his philosophy is the idea of the Übermensch, often translated as the overman or beyond man. This figure represents the one who rises above the herd, who stops living according to borrowed values, and becomes the author of his own life. The Übermensch is not about physical strength or superiority over others, it is about becoming one's own lawgiver. Most people live by rules they never question. What society tells them is right, what religion prescribes, what culture celebrates. Nietzsche challenges us to imagine what it would mean to reject all of that and to decide for ourselves from the ground up what values are worth living by. To do this requires immense courage, because it means standing apart from the safety of the crowd. One of Nietzsche's most powerful observations is that the individual has always had to struggle to keep from being overwhelmed by the tribe. This is as true today as it was in his time. The tribe promises comfort. When you belong, you are protected, you are reassured, you are not alone. But belonging also comes at a cost. The tribe demands that you think like everyone else, act like everyone else, and accept its rules without question. If you deviate, you risk rejection. This is why Nietzsche insists that the path to greatness always involves breaking free from the herd. It is a struggle, not a gift. The herd is always pulling you back, whispering that safety is better than freedom. To resist that pull requires constant effort, because our instincts push us toward acceptance. Nietzsche's reminder is that the herd may give you comfort, but it will never allow you to become who you truly are. Solitude, in Nietzsche's view, is not just a condition of life, it is a furnace in which individuality is forged. He often describes solitude as a place of incubation, where ideas that cannot survive in the noise of the crowd can finally take root. Great art, great philosophy, great insight, these are not born in the marketplace of opinions, but in the silence of solitude. Nietzsche himself lived this truth. Much of his writing was done in isolation, in small mountain towns or while wandering through the Alps. He was often lonely, sick, and misunderstood, yet it was in these very conditions that his most powerful thoughts emerged. He knew that to create something truly original, you must first separate yourself from the noise of common opinion. When you walk alone, your mind is forced inward, and it is there, in the quiet, that creativity awakens. But Nietzsche also understood the cost of this path. Solitude is not romantic or easy, it is painful. To stand apart from the herd means to face misunderstanding, ridicule, even hatred. Most people fear what they cannot categorize, and those who live by their own values often appear threatening to the comfortable illusions of society. Nietzsche himself was criticized, ignored, and dismissed in his lifetime. He endured illness and isolation, often feeling the weight of being misunderstood. Yet he never surrendered his path. His endurance reminds us that standing apart is not a momentary act, but a lifelong commitment. It demands resilience, the ability to endure loneliness without collapsing back into a conformity, simply for relief. The courage to stand apart means accepting that you may walk through long stretches of life without applause, without recognition, sometimes even without companionship. But it is in this very endurance that authenticity is born. Applying Nietzsche's lesson to modern life means rethinking the way we handle the pressure of conformity. Today, the herd is louder than ever. Social media amplifies its voice, constantly telling us what to think, what to like, what to hate. Trends shift by the hour, and the pressure to keep up can feel suffocating. At work, we are often told to follow rules we don't believe in or chase goals that don't inspire us. In personal life, we may feel pushed toward relationships, lifestyles, or beliefs simply because they are popular. To stand apart in this context means learning to live with discomfort. It means refusing to bend to every new trend, resisting the urge to fit in at the cost of your integrity, and daring to walk a slower, lonelier path if it is the path of authenticity. The danger, of course, is collapsing under the weight of solitude. This is why Nietzsche emphasized not just separation, but strength. To stand apart, you must cultivate an inner life robust enough to sustain you when external approval disappears. This is where practices like journaling become powerful tools. Writing forces you to clarify your thoughts, to define your values, and to see yourself more clearly. Nietzsche's challenge can be turned into a direct exercise. Sit down with pen and paper and ask yourself, what values do I choose if I stop following the herd? This question strips away the easy answers. If you can no longer rely on tradition, on what your peers believe, on what society rewards, what remains? What do you truly hold as good, meaningful, and worth pursuing? At first, the page may feel empty, but over time, answers emerge, and in those answers, you begin to discover the outlines of your authentic self. Journaling in this way is not about perfection or creating a polished philosophy. It is about practice. Each time you write, you strengthen the muscle of thinking for yourself. You may discover that some of your values align with society's, but now they are chosen, not inherited. You may find that others are radically different, and that difference will feel frightening because it may separate you from those around you. But this is precisely the test Nietzsche describes. To create your own values is to risk being alone, but it is also the only way to become free. The courage to stand apart is not only about ideas, it is about daily life. Imagine being in a group where everyone is agreeing on something you know is false or harmful. Do you nod along for the sake of belonging, or do you risk speaking up? Imagine choosing a career path not because it is respected or lucrative, but because it aligns with your deepest sense of purpose. Imagine refusing to chase a lifestyle simply because it looks impressive on the outside. These are the modern arenas where Nietzsche's lesson is lived. The herd will always offer the easy road, paved with comfort and approval. But the individual who dares to step off that road, to endure the uncertainty of solitude, discovers a deeper freedom. Nietzsche's vision of the Übermensch is not a distant ideal reserved for a chosen few. It is an invitation to each of us. It asks, will you continue to live by values that were handed to you, or will you create your own? Will you remain in the safety of the herd, or will you risk the loneliness of authenticity? The answer is never final. Each day presents new choices, new pressures, new temptations to conform, and each day demands courage to resist them. The path is ongoing, never completed, always requiring vigilance. What Nietzsche offers us is not comfort but challenge. He tells us that the pain of solitude is the price of freedom. He reminds us that every individual who has ever created something of lasting value, every artist, philosopher, or visionary, had to endure the loneliness of standing apart. And he invites us to see solitude not as exile, but as soil from which originality grows. So, if you are willing to take on this challenge, start with a question. Sit with yourself honestly and without distraction and ask, what values do I choose if I stop following the herd? Write down your answers. Test them in your life, see where they lead. The process will not be easy, but it will be real. And in a world drowning in conformity, that reality is the rarest treasure of all. The fear of being alone is one of the deepest and most universal fears that humans carry. It is not just a matter of personality or preference, it is written into our biology. For most of human history, survival depended on belonging to a group. A lone individual on the savannah would have had little chance of defending against predators, finding food, or surviving harsh weather. The tribe provided safety, protection, and resources, and so our brains evolved to crave belonging as much as food or water. Rejection from the group meant danger, even death. That is why even today, when the world is far safer, rejection still feels like a kind of death. Our heart races when we are criticized. Our stomach twists when we feel excluded. The fear is ancient, and it explains why people will go to almost any length to fit in. We chase approval because deep down, our bodies equate approval with survival. This evolutionary truth is precisely why society has found so many ways to exploit our fear of being alone. Consumerism thrives on it. Advertising constantly implies that without the right clothes, the newest phone, or the trendiest lifestyle, you risk being excluded. The message is subtle but powerful. Buy this product and you'll belong. Wear this brand and people will admire you. Live this way and you won't be left behind. Politics, too, exploits our tribal instincts. Leaders know that people crave the safety of an us versus them. Belonging to a political party or ideology gives people a sense of identity, and the fear of standing outside of it can be overwhelming. Social media takes this to an even higher level. Every like, share, or comment functions as a micro dose of approval, keeping us hooked on the assurance that we are not alone, that we are seen, that we matter. And yet, the paradox is clear. The more we chase approval in these systems, the less authentic we become, and the more dependent we feel. The existentialist philosophers understood this fear and examined it closely. Jean-Paul Sartre described the condition of human freedom as both liberating and terrifying. To be truly free means there is no ultimate script, no divine command, no unquestionable authority dictating our choices. That sounds empowering at first, but it also means that we cannot hide behind excuses. We are responsible for shaping our lives, and that responsibility can feel crushing. Kierkegaard, writing a century before Sartre, called this the dizziness of freedom. When you realize that you alone are responsible for your choices, it can feel like standing on the edge of a cliff, staring into the abyss. The anxiety comes not from the presence of chains, but from their absence. People often cling to groups, ideologies, or authorities because it relieves them of this terrifying freedom. If you follow the herd, then you can blame the herd for your choices. But if you walk alone, the burden falls on you entirely. And this is the central lesson. Solitude forces responsibility. When you step away from the group, when you refuse to hide in the comfort of conformity, you suddenly realize that your life is yours to shape. No one else can be blamed, no one else can decide, no one else can carry the weight. At first, this feels like a curse. Responsibility is heavy. It is much easier to let others tell you how to live, what to value, and who to be. But once you accept this responsibility, you discover its hidden gift. Responsibility is power. When you stop relying on others to carry your life, you gain the ability to direct it yourself. You may stumble, you may make mistakes, but they are your mistakes, and you learn from them. This is the foundation of strength, knowing that your life is in your own hands. Of course, breaking free from the chains of approval is easier said than done. The habits of seeking validation are deeply ingrained. This is why philosophers like the Cynics recommended the practice of voluntary discomfort. The idea is to deliberately put yourself into situations where you risk disapproval or discomfort in order to train yourself to stop fearing them. Diogenes, the most famous Cynic, practiced this in extreme ways, living in poverty and mocking the conventions of society, but we can apply the same principle in smaller, more practical ways. For example, spend a day without your phone or without checking social media. Notice how restless you feel, how strong the pull of approval is. By resisting it, you weaken its grip. Another exercise might be to wear something plain or unfashionable in public just to see how it feels not to chase admiration. You might even practice saying no more often to invitations, requests, or expectations that don't align with your values. Each small act of voluntary discomfort builds resilience against the fear of rejection. The point of these exercises is not to punish yourself, but to rewire your relationship with discomfort. When you learn that rejection, criticism, or disapproval do not destroy you, you gain confidence. You realize that you can stand apart and still survive. In fact, you discover that solitude is not as frightening as it once seemed. It becomes a space where you can hear your own thoughts, make your own choices, and live by your own values. The fear of being alone does not vanish overnight, but with practice, it shrinks. What once felt like chains begins to feel like an opportunity. To walk alone is to step into responsibility. To step into responsibility is to step into power. And while the fear of being alone is natural, it is also a test. Those who run from it will forever remain chained to the tribe, chasing approval and avoiding freedom. But those who face it, who endure its anxiety and learn to live with it, will discover the strength of authenticity. This is the courage that the existentialists point us toward, and it is the courage that anyone can practice today through deliberate, honest steps. Solitude may begin as fear, but if embraced, it becomes the foundation of true freedom.
Thank you.
Solitude is often seen as emptiness, as a void to be filled, but for those who dare to embrace it, solitude becomes the richest soil for creativity. When you are alone, the noise of the world quiets and something extraordinary happens. You begin to hear yourself. Ideas that were drowned out by the constant chatter of others suddenly emerge. Questions that had been buried under daily distractions rise to the surface. Solitude is not just the absence of people, it is the presence of your own mind in its purest state. This is why solitude has always been the birthplace of art, philosophy, and self-discovery. The greatest works of thought and creativity rarely emerge from crowded rooms or loud debates. They come from the silence of someone daring to sit alone, to wrestle with their thoughts, and to put them into words or actions that change the world. Consider Marcus Aurelius, Emperor of Rome, commanding legions on the front lines of war. He was the most powerful man of his age, surrounded by generals, advisors, and soldiers. Yet his most enduring legacy was not his empire, but his private reflections written in solitude. His book, Meditations, was not intended for the world. It was his personal journal, written late at night or early in the morning while camped near battlefields. In the midst of war and responsibility, Marcus turned inward. He used solitude to remind himself of what was true, what was virtuous, what was worth striving for. Those quiet writings, created in stolen moments of aloneness, outlived the empire he ruled. They remind us that solitude is not about escaping responsibility, it is about creating the space to see clearly even within it. Nietzsche, too, found his most powerful insights not in universities or crowded salons, but in the solitude of the mountains. He spent years wandering through the Alps, often sick and alone, carrying notebooks in which he poured his thoughts. It was there, far from the herd of society, that he conceived some of his most radical ideas. The death of God, the eternal recurrence, the Übermensch. His solitude was not easy. It was filled with pain, misunderstanding, and isolation. Yet it was in that very pain that his philosophy was born. Nietzsche once wrote that one must have chaos within to give birth to a dancing star. That chaos is not found in conformity. It is discovered in solitude, where no one shields you from your own questions. Henry David Thoreau provides another example, choosing solitude not out of exile, but out of deliberate experiment. In 1845, he built a small cabin near Walden Pond in Massachusetts and lived there for over 2 years. His purpose was to strip life down to its essentials, to see what remained when all distractions and luxuries were removed. In that solitude, he wrote Walden, a book that still inspires people today to rethink their lives, to simplify, and to live deliberately. Thoreau's solitude was not absolute. He sometimes visited friends in town, but his experiment showed the creative power of stepping away from the noise of society. By walking alone, he created a vision of simplicity and authenticity that continues to shape generations. What all of these examples reveal is a profound paradox. When you walk alone, you create truths that others will eventually follow. The solitary thinker, the outsider, the one who dares to step apart, often becomes the source of wisdom for the very crowd they left behind. Marcus Aurelius wrote only for himself, but his words became guidance for millions. Nietzsche endured loneliness, but his philosophy reshaped modern thought. Thoreau lived in a cabin, seemingly cut off, yet his writings continued to inspire movements toward simplicity and environmental awareness. Solitude seems like separation, but in reality it becomes connection at a deeper level. By walking alone, you may be misunderstood for a time, but eventually, others recognize the value of what you discovered in silence. This creative power of solitude has practical applications for all of us, even if we are not emperors, philosophers, or poets. The challenge of modern life is that it leaves almost no room for silence. we are bombarded with notifications, surrounded by constant chatter, and conditioned to believe that productivity means busyness. Yet creativity requires emptiness. It requires stretches of time where nothing external is demanding your attention. This is why it is so important to build rituals of solitude into your life. It could be something as simple as a daily walk without headphones, letting your mind wander freely. It could be setting aside an hour each morning or evening for journaling, meditation, or creative work without distraction. These rituals do not need to be grand. They need to be consistent. Solitude works slowly, like water shaping stone. Over time, it creates space within you where originality can emerge. Meditation is one of the most powerful practices of solitude. Sitting quietly, focusing on your breath or a simple word, you begin to notice how noisy your own mind can be. At first, the solitude feels restless, uncomfortable, even boring. But as you practice, you discover that beneath the surface lies clarity. Insights rise unexpectedly, creativity blossoms, and your sense of self deepens. Another practice is deliberate creative solitude, setting aside time to write, paint, design, or problem solve without interruptions. In these moments, you enter what many call flow, a state where time disappears and you are fully immersed in creation. Flow is almost impossible in constant company or distraction. It requires solitude. One of the simplest yet most profound exercises is what could be called the philosopher's walk. Choose one day each week to go for a walk alone, without music, without your phone, without conversation. As you walk, carry one question in your mind. It could be something personal. What do I truly want? Or something universal. What does it mean to live well? The point is not to find an immediate answer, but to live with the question in silence. As you walk, your thoughts will shift, your mind will wander, and gradually insights will emerge. The philosopher's walk is a way of combining solitude with movement, body with mind. It becomes a ritual where you meet yourself more deeply than you can in the noise of daily life. Solitude may seem unproductive in a culture obsessed with speed and results, but it is precisely what makes true productivity possible. Without it, we merely react, repeat, and conform. With it, we create, discover, and transform. The creative power of walking alone is not reserved for geniuses. It is available to anyone willing to make space for silence. The challenge is to overcome the fear of being alone long enough to discover the richness within it. Once you do, solitude becomes not emptiness, but fullness. Not exile, but home. The lesson is simple yet profound. If you want to create, if you want to discover who you really are, you must learn to walk alone, not forever, not as an escape, but as a practice of authenticity. The paradox is that the more you embrace solitude, the more you will have to offer others. The truths discovered in silence eventually echo across time, guiding those who are still caught in the noise. By walking alone, you may light a path that others will someday follow, and even if they do not, you will have walked your own path, which is the greatest creation of all. Dangerous freedom is the final stage of walking alone. Up to this point, solitude has been shown as a source of strength, clarity, and creativity, but we must also face its cost. To live without following the crowd, without hiding behind the safety of belonging, is to risk rejection. People who walk alone are often mocked, distrusted, even feared. Human beings, by instinct, are suspicious of those who do not conform. The herd feels threatened when someone refuses to obey its rules. Think of the child in school who is bullied simply for being different, or the employee who is criticized for questioning the way things are done. At every stage of life, the world tries to push us back into sameness. To resist is to invite ridicule and misunderstanding. And yet, history shows that every person who ever changed the world endured this cost. To be authentic, to stand by your own truth, is to accept that you will sometimes walk through life alone. The danger of walking alone is not just social, it can be existential. Those who reject the herd may face exile, poverty, or worse. Socrates was sentenced to death for questioning the foundations of Athenian society. Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake for teaching that the universe was infinite. Even in less extreme ways, outsiders are punished. They may lose their careers, their reputations, their friendships. This is why most people never dare to walk alone for long. The price feels too high, safety is seductive, and comfort whispers louder than courage. But if you always choose safety, you lose yourself. You remain imprisoned, never knowing what it would feel like to live honestly. The ultimate cost of walking alone is danger, but the ultimate cost of avoiding it is slavery. Yet what waits on the other side of this danger is something rare and precious: unbreakable authenticity. When you no longer live for approval, when you're not chained by fear of rejection, you finally become free to be yourself. This authenticity is not given. It is earned through the trials of solitude. It cannot be taken away because it no longer depends on external things. If the world mocks you, you remain steady. If the world ignores you, you continue walking. If the world rejects you, you stand unshaken because your value no longer rests in the hands of others. This kind of authenticity is stronger than any armor. It is not loud or arrogant. It is quiet, resilient, and unyielding. It is the authenticity of someone who has faced themselves in solitude and emerged whole. Albert Camus captured this spirit when he wrote, "The only way to deal with an unfree world is to become so absolutely free that your very existence is an act of rebellion." This is the essence of dangerous freedom. To live authentically in a world that thrives on conformity is to rebel simply by being yourself. You don't need to shout slogans or wave banners. Your existence, lived in truth, is enough to unsettle the system. Every time you choose your own path, instead of following blindly, you prove that another way is possible. Every time you refuse to surrender your integrity for approval, you strike a blow against the unfreedom of the herd. Dangerous freedom means that you may be hated, but you cannot be controlled. It means that your very life becomes a statement, "I will not be owned." The lesson here is both liberating and terrifying. You don't need a tribe, you become your own tribe. Most people spend their lives searching for groups to belong to, labels to wear, ideologies to adopt. They fear standing alone, so they cling to any identity that promises security. But the one who walks alone discovers that the deepest belonging comes not from a group, but from self-possession. When you become your own tribe, you carry within you the values, the strength, and the clarity that others seek outside themselves. You may still connect with others, you may still love and build friendships, but these connections are chosen freely, not born out of desperation to avoid solitude. This shift transforms relationships. Instead of clinging to others for validation, you bring authenticity into every bond. You do not need them to complete you, and because of that, your love is purer, your friendship stronger, your presence freer. But how do we embrace this dangerous freedom in practical terms? How do we endure being disliked, misunderstood, or ignored without collapsing into bitterness? The first step is acceptance. Expect rejection, expect mockery, expect misunderstanding. When you anticipate it, you are not surprised when it comes. You recognize it as part of the price of authenticity. Instead of fearing it, you see it as confirmation that you are walking your own path. If everyone approves of you, it may be a sign that you are simply blending in. Being disliked is not necessarily failure. It is often proof of individuality. The second step is reframing. Instead of seeing rejection as evidence that something is wrong with you, view it as evidence that you are no longer dependent on approval. When someone dislikes you for being authentic, they are really expressing discomfort at their own conformity. Your independence exposes their dependence. This is why outsiders are often mocked. They remind others of the freedom they have not dared to claim. Reframing rejection in this way turns pain into strength. Every disapproving glance becomes a reminder that you are walking a path that is truly your own. The third step is building inner practices that anchor you when external support fades. This could be journaling daily to remind yourself of your values, meditating to cultivate inner stillness, or creating art that expresses your truth. These practices make you less vulnerable to the opinions of others because they keep you grounded in who you are. Without them, the weight of rejection can become overwhelming. With them, rejection becomes noise that cannot drown out your inner voice. This path is not for everyone, and it is not meant to be easy. Dangerous freedom demands courage, endurance, and resilience, but it also offers the one thing that no amount of conformity can give: the peace of living honestly. When you walk alone, you may lose the comfort of the tribe, but you gain yourself. You discover a freedom so complete that it unsettles the world around you. You no longer ask, "Will they accept me?" Instead, you ask, "Am I being true to myself?" And when the answer is yes, the noise of rejection becomes irrelevant. The world will always pressure you to return to the herd. It will tempt you with approval, scare you with threats, and shame you with mockery. But if you hold firm, if you accept the cost and claim the reward, you will embody what Camus described. A life that itself is an act of rebellion. You will prove that it is possible to live authentically, even in an unfree world. That is dangerous freedom. It may leave you alone, but it will never leave you empty. And in the end, it is better to walk alone in truth than to be surrounded in a lie.